Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. So it's a lot scarier to watch than to hear over the radio, but I'm sure you've seen it by now. Terrifying video showing children flying out of their seats as a school bus in Ohio hit by a car overturned before the driver could calmly get up and help get students off of that school bus. It made a lot of you question the safety of school buses, and we certainly, in my own understanding, have not seen that here in Connecticut. But it does kind of prompt the question, how safe are our school buses? What do we do to ensure the safety of our children? So I wanted to have someone on the show this morning to talk about those things. Joining me now, new to the show, is Mason Thrall, and he is the Director of Operations for CREC, which stands for Capital Region Education Council. And Mason, welcome to the show. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Melissa.
So just for people's background, my understanding is CREC oversees security, transportation. You guys have a garage on property that services the school buses. You have an IT department, construction facilities. So there's an awful lot that CREC oversees. And your job, particular director of operations, school buses fall under that category, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. In addition to that, we operate magnet schools and special education schools throughout the greater Hartford area.
Okay. So, Mason, I wanted to start with something simple that a lot of my listeners were asking me about this week. Why aren't seatbelts something now put on all school buses, especially because Connecticut just fixed our laws that if you sit in the backseat of a car, you now are required to wear a seatbelt, but you're not required to wear one on school buses?
So there's actually currently only 8 states in the country that do have seatbelt laws. And 2 of those states, those laws are subject to appropriations and they haven't been funded yet. Some of those laws require use and some don't. Some require lap seatbelts and some require shoulder seatbelts. In Connecticut, they do not have any seatbelt laws. The Connecticut legislature a few years back did pass an incentive for school districts, offering them rebates on the sales tax for purchase of buses with seatbelts, but that didn't take off very well. And the reason why there are no seatbelts on most buses is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that vehicles over 10,000 pounds do not need passenger restraints. And seatbelts specifically are built different than passenger cars. School buses have what's called compartmentalization inside them. So the seats are close together and they have high energy absorbing padded seats. So, you know, it's padded all around you. Some of your older listeners may remember when they were kids back in the 70s, the seat backs to buses on buses were metal and they had metal bars exposed. Mm-hmm. And that's all been improved. It's all compartmentalized now and energy absorbing seats. Also, school buses, they have the passenger windows are placed higher. They have real tough joint strength, extra reinforced joint strength. They have reinforced body frames with rollover protection. Of course, they have the semaphore lights, so when they're at bus stops, traffic should be stopped or at least slowed down around them. And the buses also ride at a higher profile than more vehicles. They're higher up off the ground. You see a lot of bus accidents. You'll notice that the cars go under the bumpers, whether it's the front of the bus or the rear of the
True.
Bus. The cars usually go underneath.
So I'm hearing a couple of different things here, Mason, which was a great explanation, by the way. So first and foremost, it sounds like the highway safety, the National Highway Safety Commission, the reason that they don't probably feel you need seatbelts on buses is, first of all, I would think speed is a factor. Like, they can only go so fast versus, you know, you've got cars, unfortunately, on Connecticut highways, for example, that right now, with the problems we've been seeing on the roads, will go 90, 100 miles an hour. I mean, how fast do school buses go on average? They don't probably go anywhere near as fast.
No, in fact, buses in Connecticut are not supposed to go over 50 miles an hour.
Okay. So, I mean, a lot of the times when you have those restraints, it's literally, a lot of the times it's because you're going way too fast. And when you hit on impact, it's to save you from being ejected from a car or to be ejected from your seat, you know, into the windshield. That's one of the bigger reasons. So that makes sense. And a couple of other things that you brought up, you know, this accident in particular where somebody slammed into this bus and it tipped. I mean, in your professional opinion, that probably doesn't happen very often. It's kind of like if you took down a moose, for example, like when you come head on with a moose, the moose always wins. I would imagine most times the bus is going to win in a collision.
Absolutely. And that goes back to the reinforced construction of the bus. You know, very few vehicles on the road today are built as safe as a bus. And, you know, school buses are undisputedly the safest way for children to get to and from school, and the statistics just bear that out.
That makes a lot of sense. Had some great questions from listeners this week, and I thought, well, we're due for a school bus report. So Mason is here this morning answering our questions. Another question besides seatbelts, Mason, I was asked about monitors on buses, and time and time again, I've been told it probably comes down to a money thing. We already have problems just trying to recruit police officers, but I wasn't sure your thoughts on why we don't have monitors on buses, especially with cars who just bypass buses, or if there's ever an incident on the bus and a school bus driver is busy driving. Why don't we have monitors on school buses?
So just to be clear, there are monitors on some buses. Students who have IEPs, which individual education plans, or 504 plans that specify that they need monitors or help on the vehicle, they do have those. And also longer routes, like here in the Hartford region, where we do a lot of magnet school transportation, inter-district transportation, and we have students on the buses for over an hour at a time, some of those bus routes do, in fact, have monitors.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
But in general, most of the routes in Connecticut do not have monitors on them, and they don't have monitors on them because most of the routes, one of the big reasons, most of the routes in Connecticut are very short. If you look around, Connecticut has 160-something school districts, and each one of those districts has their own transportation. So in most cases, the inter-district routes are 20, 25 minutes long. So in most cases, a monitor isn't really needed on those shorter bus routes.
Okay. Do you feel like it's gotten better with the whole bus stopping to let kids out and in cars passing? I remember being a reporter years ago and doing a ride along, and a police officer was on the bus with us, and they would see drivers blatantly bypass the buses, and of course that puts the kids at harm if they have to cross the street. Do you feel like that's still a big problem in Connecticut, or do you think it's gotten a lot better?
It's always been a challenge, and I think it always will be a challenge. The police are really great at helping us out when we identify areas that are particularly bad. And in a lot of cases, on busy roadways, we will actually route the buses so that the students do not have to cross the street, even though, you know, we do have to stop on signal lights if the street is busy and we do have a history of cars passing those lights. We route the buses so that they don't have to cross the street.
That makes a lot of sense. And we're chatting this morning. So glad to have him here. Mason Thrall, who is the director of operations at CREC, which stands for Capital Region Education Council. And we're talking about school buses. So another thing I wanted to talk about, Mason, I know this was an issue well before the pandemic, and I can only imagine that COVID made it a lot harder. How are we doing with recruiting school bus drivers across Connecticut and even just retaining good ones?
I am glad you asked that question, Melissa, because it is absolutely probably the worst I've ever seen it.
Really?
As far as driver shortages go. I would tell your listeners, if you're interested or you know anybody who's good with children and likes to drive, call your local school bus company. Everybody is hiring right now. It's a great job if you like children and you like to drive. Everybody's hiring. It is a shortage across the board.
And I would think it's pretty flexible, Mason. Give people an idea. Could you do like a morning shift and not an afternoon? Are you required to do both? What are the hours like? How's the training for people who are thinking, okay, especially if you're semi-retired and you're thinking, maybe I'll pick up a job. Like, how does it all work? What would you be required to do?
Sure. So typically the job has two shifts a day, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. You come in usually sometime around 6 or 7 a.m., go out and do a route for a couple hours, come back, and then you come back in the afternoon, usually somewhere around 2 o'clock, and go out again for a couple hours, and that's your day. Typically, there is extra work available for those folks that want to pick up extra hours. There's midday routes, there's late routes, there's field trips, athletic trips, so there are extra opportunities there for folks who want to work more. As far as getting your license goes, all the bus companies train you. They'll take you through it step by step. You will have to get a CDL license with a passenger and a school bus endorsement. When you go in and apply, the companies will take you right through it. You'll have to have a bunch of record checks done, including driver history, a DCF check, a sex offender registry, and a state and national criminal record check. And then you begin your training. Drivers typically do 30 to 40 hours of training. Some of that is in a classroom, and most of it is on the road. And then you have to take a test with the motor vehicle department. You take a written test, and once you pass that, then you schedule on the road test. And then once you pass that, you get your license, and typically a bus company will have you work with another driver for a little bit, and then you're on your own.
And I think you just kind of calm the nerves of any parents out there who think, okay, well, we're dealing with a shortage. Doesn't seem like there's an awful lot of training or a lot that you have to do to get your license, but it sounds like you're vetted pretty carefully to become a school bus driver here in Connecticut, which I think you have to do, which I think is good. But sometimes when you have a shortage, people wonder if you cut corners. It doesn't sound like that's happening.
No, there's no cutting corners. The record checks are mandatory. You can't go on to the next step until you pass the first step. So, you have to do the record checks. You have to do the training. You have to pass the written test to get to the on-the-road test. And along the way, all that stuff is being checked over and over again to make sure you've done everything. It takes 3 to 4 months to get a driver's license.
Well,
a school bus driver's license.
If anything, Mason, I think then this is perfect timing. We're having you on. You got May through August to get it together before the school year starts. So,
100%. And again, I highly encourage anybody who's interested, or if you know anybody who likes to drive and loves children, it's a great job. You can get from 20 hours a week up to over 40 hours a week, Every bus company is hiring right now, so go see your local bus companies, and they'll put you to work.
All right. Mason Thrall, it was such a pleasure to have you on the show. I hope you'll come back soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Anytime.
All right. Mason Thrall here, who's the Director of Operations at CREC, standing for Capital Region Education Council, right here on WICC. A tragic story that happened this week. A 24-year-old woman died after she was stabbed several times in front of young children at her home in Waterbury. Police say they have charged her husband with the murder. This is another unfortunate classic case of domestic violence, unfortunately. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about domestic violence, but really the bigger thing here is that detail in there. Did you pick it up that there were children in the home? And apparently this happens far too often. And we might be seeing an increase of that going on in Connecticut when it comes to domestic violence incidents. Joining me this morning is the CEO of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. That's Megan Scanlon. And we welcome Megan to the show this morning. Thanks for being here, Megan. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So I'm glad to have you here. I think this story immediately brought me back to the Ansonia story, where a mother of three was also that case is also pending, but her husband is facing charges as well in her murder because there was domestic violence issues, and there were two of her three children at home, one of which is special needs. And I thought of that case, and I thought, wow, this seems to be happening more and more. You hear about the kids being home. Are you finding that trend as well?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing that trend over last year into and spilling over into this year. So last year we had 11 confirmed domestic violence homicides. There's two cases still pending. And in those 11, four of the cases, children witnessed the event. When it comes to Ansonia and the Waterbury case recently, what's even more disturbing about those is that the level of violence being used in those instances has definitely increased. So that's something that we're also really concerned about as we move into this new year.
So what kind of trauma, just to help us to understand it, because I think we as people witness trauma even when we don't want to. I mean, mm-hmm. something as simple as 9/11, you know, that was traumatic for many people who watched it on television. But when you watch your parents, who are not getting along, you've probably been watching that happening, when you watched that degree of violence going on in your home, and then the realization as well that you've probably lost two parents, one who's perished and the other who's now going to sit behind bars for the crime. What is mm-hmm. the amount of trauma these kids are kind of going through?
I mean, the amount of trauma of children that witness domestic violence, but then, you know, on top of that, the murder of one or both in some instances of their parents is inexcusable, right? I mean, we will work with the families. We have family and child advocates on the ground that their sole role is to provide support and counseling and trauma-informed services to the children and the family members that they hopefully will be with. But there's no question that these instances, whether it results in a homicide or whether it's a continued lengthy period of time witnessing either emotional, physical, or other abuse in the home, and these have lifelong impacts on the children, and they have no control in the situation, right? So they are sort of defined by this moment that they had no choice in. And so what we try to do is give them the skills to understand healthy relationships and to try to move beyond and have this be, obviously, it's part of their story. We can't take that away, but at least try to give them the skills that they need in order for it not to define their whole story, right? So that's where we are. And it's unfortunate. And I think it's something that happens, like you said, it's happening more often than we talk about. And it's really a public health crisis at this point.
We're talking this morning, I should say, to Megan Scanlon, who's the CEO of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Your data, I just want to let people know, Megan, it's based on the calls you guys are getting, right? You know, when you talk about the data, okay, I just want to make sure I have that right. On average, I mean, how many calls have you guys been getting? Do you have any stats from just this last year? And is it up, especially due to the pandemic? Yeah.
Yes. So we run the statewide domestic violence hotline. So to give people context on that, And last year in 2021, we had over 28,000 contacts. And contacts, I say, because you can call, you can email, you can text, or you can chat. So you can access the hotline in those ways. So we had over 28,000 contacts, which is up from the previous year, and is continuing in that trend as we're going into 2022. So I think, unfortunately, I know, you know, the pandemic exacerbated an issue that was already a problem before the pandemic, and a lot of, you know, the restrictions and isolation around COVID, I think, has made it worse in some instances for families that are experiencing this violence at home. And we're really working every day to try to combat that and give victims more options to stay safe. So I think that's a big piece of this, is for anybody listening that might be going through something, whether it's escalated to physical or not, to know that there are resources out there. There are over 400 advocates across the state that can help you navigate this situation and get you into a safe space.
Do you think the state of Connecticut does enough to support kids specifically in domestic violence homes?
You know, it's actually really funny timing that you asked that. So we this year went to the legislature to get them to invest in the family and child advocate position. There's no state funding to support that role that focuses directly on the children impacted by this trauma. And we are sort of in the last week of session, in the fight of our lives to make sure that we get that funding through. So I would say, you know, they've been a good partner so far, but if they can't get this done, then what they're saying is that children don't matter. So I would say no, historically they haven't done enough, but I'm hopeful that in last couple of days that they will be able to get this funding passed, and it will be a lifeline to these families and to these children.
So the funding you said is for like a specific kind of physician?
It's for our family and child advocate position. It is the position I mentioned earlier that essentially works directly with the children who have been impacted by domestic violence. And in many instances, the non-offending parent, and really helps provide trauma-informed services, counseling, getting them connected to other community supports, making sure that they have the skills and the techniques that are relevant to their situation to be able to move beyond the trauma and be able to live a safe and healthy life beyond the experiences that they had.
Does it sound like they're going to clear that funding, Megan?
I am hopeful that they will. We have some work to do today to make sure that that happens. And I'm really hopeful that that will at least pass the House and the Senate in the budget.
Megan, can you give people your website and the number if people need help and are looking for your resources?
Yeah, so the website is ctsafeconnect.com, and the hotline number, which you can actually call or text, is 888-774-2900.
Okay, 888-774-2900. And Megan Scanlon, the CEO of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, we appreciate the work that you do here in Connecticut, and I thank you so much for sharing your time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
All right, Megan Scanlon right here on WICC.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you. Melissa in the Morning welcomes Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
We're not attacking Russia. We're helping Ukraine defend itself against Russian aggression.
So you're hearing from President Biden this morning and seeking $33 billion more in aid for Ukraine. And we have Congressman Jim Himes here this morning with the latest. Good morning, Congressman Himes. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Doing great. Thank you.
So last night was a pretty big deal, what was going on in Ukraine, the latest from Russia. And now the president calling for another boatload of money to go over to help Ukraine. I'm curious, before we dive into what that money is going to do, are these same efforts coming from other NATO countries for people who maybe need reference? Like, are other NATO countries offering similar packages to help Ukraine?
Yeah, they are. Not in that size, obviously, because none of the countries that we're working with, you know, Great Britain, France, Poland, Germany, you know, have the size of the budget that we do. But yes, and in fact, they're doing more in some ways, right? So if you think about, you know, Poland, for example, which is right there on the border, Poland is not only providing weapons to the Ukrainians, but they're dealing with hundreds of thousands of refugees who come across their border, right? So, you know, they've set up field hospitals and, you know, are dealing with a huge humanitarian issue. So, the countries, certainly the ones in the region that are dealing with the direct fallout of the conflict are stepping up. And make no mistake, I haven't actually seen what's in the $33 billion because that was announced yesterday. But as you point out, boatload is a good way to discuss it, is a good way to describe it. So, you know, I mean, to put that in context for you, you know, that's something like half the size of the Russian military budget, right? So, you know, Congress is going to scrutinize it and make sure that it's smart spending. A lot of that, by the way, we should say, a lot of that $33 billion is not weaponry. A lot of that is, you know, money that will allow for field hospitals, for the treatment of the, you know, now what are we at, like 2 million or something, people who have been displaced from Ukraine, who, you know, who need food, who need health care, who need shelter. So I can't get into chapter and verse what's in it because the president just announced it. But Congress is going to do its job and make sure it's a smart proposal and that it, you know, is consistent with the interests of the American people.
And I know last week we really dived into this, Congressman Himes. When people hear the amount of money that's being spent, they think, why are we spending this on another country? But there's a trickle down effect. You know, the thing that you were kind of talking about that I think makes sense is that if we don't get involved, first of all, we're not sending boots in. So that's the big thing, is that we don't actually have troops there on the grounds fighting this war, which is a good thing. But if we don't do something and Russia really does take over Ukraine, what message that sends to other countries who may want to take over other countries just because they feel like it. So the understanding of why we're sending money, I think it's the quote from the president saying, look, the cost of this fight is not cheap. And I think I was reading a report earlier that the amount of money we are now spending on Ukraine is more than tripling the total emergency expenditures. And actually, it's coming out to be about what we spent being in Afghanistan, which is more than I think we had thought. So I guess the question is, you know, how long? Because I don't know how long this war is going to last. You know, some experts are saying this could be several more months that this goes on. You know, will we run out of money? What sort of gets cut essentially because we're spending money on Ukraine, or how much debt are we putting ourselves into essentially?
Yeah. I'm not sure what you saw about the cost of Afghanistan, but you know, all in right now, we've probably, this $33 billion is an idea, you know, all in right now, we've probably, you know, provided, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but let's just say somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 billion of aid to Ukraine. That's a tiny, tiny fraction of what we spent over 20 years in Afghanistan.
Okay.
So we're not there yet. But look, you articulated it exactly right. You know, Russia's made no bones about what it does, right? You know, we may not have noticed quite the way we noticed with Ukraine, but they invaded Georgia. They invaded any number of other countries, Chechnya, around their borders. Were he to succeed in Ukraine, most experts will tell you that, you know, Poland's in danger, Germany's in danger, and there's two categories of huge risk for us in that. Number one, there is a point where we do fight them, right? And you know, probably going into a NATO country like Poland would be that point. We are obligated by treaty to help defend Poland, and you know, that's not a world in which we want. But it's also not just Russia, right? I mean, if Putin had been able to take Ukraine in a week, like he hoped he might have, what do you think the Chinese would be thinking about and maybe even doing in Taiwan right now? You know, the world is full of people who, like Putin, don't acknowledge the rules that most of us live by. It's not just, you know, Russia and China. It's mm-hmm. North Korea. It's Iran. And, you know, sadly, were that to be the thing that happened around the world, eventually our troops would be involved and it would be a heck of a lot more expensive than it is now. So, look, we've got a duty to make sure that we don't impoverish the United States or the American people through our activities defending democracy. But we're not close to that point yet. And you know, part of the reason that guys like me are going to have to be really thoughtful about this is because we're really threading a needle, right? We need Ukraine to win, but it's not just our boots on the ground. It's also, you know, Putin is a nuclear armed, you know, Russia is a nuclear armed country. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be, you know, within a country mile of a situation where we're worried about a nuclear exchange. So it really is a question of threading this needle.
So, Congressman Himes, if I understand you correctly, you don't think we're at a point, though, where we are going to have to start either cutting back or even taxing other people to basically fund what we're doing for Ukraine, essentially, with the because the big thing is I don't know if even President Biden thought it would go on this long and that we would be dishing out the amount of money that we now are dishing out. So I just don't know what has to give for this money to go over.
We're not close to that point, Melissa. The federal budget has been a little strange these last couple of years because there's been such extraordinary spending for COVID. But let's put this into perspective. Again, I'll by next week when we talk, I'll have the exact amount of money that is spent, but it's in the neighborhood right now of $15 to $20 billion. To address the COVID emergency over the last 3 years, the government deployed $5 trillion, right? So what we're talking about here is less than a percentage point of what we deployed to hopefully defeat COVID. We're not sure we defeated it, but hopefully defeat COVID.
Right.
You know, we're talking less than a percent right now of the money that we deployed to defeat COVID. So, yeah, we're not at a point right now where we're going to be cutting back on, you know, highways and our own defense and stuff. But, you know, you're right to ask the question. You're right to ask the question. Anytime you get involved in a conflict, you know, every single day you should ask yourself the question, how does this end and what can we do to bring this end about? Because apart from the money, there's obviously a huge amount of human suffering going on, too.
No question. I think sometimes when you hear, you know, overnight, $33 billion, I think people just go to, oh, my gosh, where is this money coming from? And what does that mean for me? And how does that help our country? So I think, you know, when you put things into perspective, like that comparison of being less than a percentage point compared to what we spent during COVID for just America, that puts it into perspective, which is why I asked the question.
Yeah.
So I appreciate
it.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. Congressman Himes, I know we've run out of time, but I do appreciate having you on the show and talking to us about it. Certainly, if you find out more details on this money and all of that, would love to talk more about it next week. Would be great.
That sounds good. I'm sure I'll have the details. We can talk about that next week.
All right. Congressman Himes, appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
All right. You too.